begin the evening. How would you investigate despair and fear? What does investigation look like? Well, it looks different for the different states one has to deal with, so that something like despair and fear are really, they're very extreme, they're intimidating, it's extremely unpleasant, so that one has to be sort of the investigation of that really has to be quite gentle, just being present, just sort of, as on a certain level, just sort of coming up to it and seeing how one what the response is, how much room one has for taking it in, so that the investigation is also, it's not just sort of investigating that out there, but it's also investigating what are my resources, what do I have to deal with? What can I use to? What can I rely on to work with? A lot of the investigation that we do is a lot of it is more being willing to be present, so that you can quite naturally notice clearly what's actually happening, what's going on. What's the feeling? What's the habit? Am I pulling away, or am I being intimidated by that? So there's those that kind of attention to the actual feelings that we're experiencing. And also, I mean, in terms of what does investigation look like? I think, you never know what it's going to look like, so you never know what's going to happen. So there has to be a certain amount of okay. Well, this is what it is. This retreat feels like specializing in silence. It's a comment, but I think it's an apt comment. There's a I don't know what's going on in anybody else's mind, but in my mind, I'm projecting that people are quite settled. it just has a very good feel to it. I appreciate the group and holding the group. I am working with a repetitive thought that's bringing up doubt, worry, and anxiety. It seems strong, sneaky, nagging, and insistent. I must be feeding it somehow, or why would it keep coming up again and again? How to work with a repetitive thought? One of the ways there's a variety of ways of working with repetitive thought. And that the Buddha himself recommends, and that, because sometimes you have to use thought to counter thought, so that we tend to think, if I could just get rid of that thought, then my mind would settle down. But sometimes you actually have to recognize you need to use the thought in order to change the. Shift the position. So it's like taking something, and the image that the Buddha gives is like a carpenter, because in the Buddha's time they didn't have nails, but they used like dowels and wooden pegs. And so that taking a smaller wooden peg and knock out the big one. So taking a thought and knocking out the thought of sort of repetitive anxiety. So taking a thought of something that is positive or reminds one of the teachings or something, using that as a means of sort of just shifting the thought, changing it in some way, so that putting the energy into lifting up and applying a different thought so that it can, and then it leaves a different tone, feeling tone in the mind and can shift. Sometimes just looking at the thought itself and, oh God, this is so dreary and wearisome, and really sort of seeing it, just say, wow, this is so pathetic. And not and it's important to not sort of, it's not kind of really judgmental and harsh and putting yourself down, but it's like, it's still pathetic. it's almost like giving oneself permission to let it go. Put it down. You know, another way of just looking at it is really, really trying to hold things much lighter than we tend to do. In the sense of, you know, it's there's worry, there's anxiety, there's doubt coming up, and then. But then to just sort of frame it in a way that doesn't take oneself so seriously or take the situation so seriously, said, you know, sort of in the end, you know, the sun comes up in the morning, it goes down at night, and the thought is just a thought, and sometimes it's helpful just playing with images of. Absurd. Like sometimes it's like taking a thought to an extreme absurdity. So then, I can put it down. It's this. That's where that thought keeps. If I really think it through, that's where it's going to end up. So it's like playing with it, being light with it, and then it you're able to put it down. Okay. Please help with a right understanding and the reflection on the 32 parts. I have had problems with this since first hearing it for the following two reasons. One, the quote-unquote bag of the body is not sealed. Gases, liquids, and solids pass continuously in and out of it, which is already, that's a good reflection. Because that's actually it's in the Visuddhimagga where it talks sort of the bag with nine holes, which is just kind of gross, but it's what it is. And two, unattractive. It does seem good to correct any idealized fantasy of the body to keep from falling off the path into a ditch of sensuous indulgence. However, mightn't the squeamish and highly opinionated view of the body expressed in this reflection lead to the equivalent of falling into the ditch on the other side? After all, I'm grateful to the bones, pus, blood, sweat, etc. that keep the old bod ticking along. It's true. Because it's a balance that one has to strike, and what you're doing it's just a tool rather than a sort of a statement of ultimate truth, and it's what one uses what's helpful for balancing the perspectives and views and ways we hold positions about. About the body, our own bodies, bodies of others, and if it's in the spectrum of an idealized fantasy that bringing up sensual desire, then it's going to lead to suffering. If it's a negative view. Of aversion or a sense of disgust, That's on the other side of the spectrum and is unwholesome, it's unskillful, that leads to suffering. So it's more using, it's one of the tools in our tool bag for finding a balance so that we can really settle. There's a story in the suttas where the Buddha gives a talk on the 32 parts of the body, and it's sort of one of these gung-ho reflections on the bane of the body, and then he went off on retreat, and some of the monks got so disgusted with their body that they committed suicide. So 2 weeks later, the Buddha comes out of retreat and is walking around and said, "Ask Ananda, the community seems to be diminished." And of course, Ananda lets him know what's happened. He said, "Okay, we need to call a meeting." And then the Buddha sort of both expressed the sense of say the wrong view of aversion toward the body, and it's also one of the occasions when the Buddha taught mindfulness of breathing. So I'd say the use of mindfulness of breathing as a balance to the either the attraction or aversion that we tend to fall into. Kindly comment on the differences in meaning and in experience between the sensual desire of tanha and the hindrance of sensual desire associated with the other desire. I forget the name, the neutral desire, so chanda. But the actual meaning and experience are the same. It's just that chanda is used in different contexts and can be qualified in a positive way, or it can be in that when I said like dhamma chanda as desire, kusala chanda, the desire for the wholesome, or sometimes chanda on its own in the context when it has other things around it, like effort, investigation, though then it's taken and used in a neutral or positive way. But in the hindrance of sensual desire it's a hindrance. So it would be the equivalent of, say, the gama tanha, sensual desire, where tanha. But tanha, when it's used, is all in whatever way, shape, or form, it always will lead to suffering. Whereas that chanda needs to be qualified, and then it's an idiom in the language of the Buddha using it for the hindrance of sensual desire. But it's called kama chanda in the sense of desire for sensuality. Is Nibbana the ending of kamma, or rather the fruition of skillful kamma? What is meant by kamma that results in neither good nor bad kamma in regard to the Buddha's explanation of the four kinds of action? Good, bad, good and bad, neither good nor bad. How to understand volition, intention, in relation to kamma and nibbana. Nibbana is the ending of kamma, but it is also the fruition of skillful kamma. But there's a point where one has to, or one sees through kamma, so that there is a, when I say an ending of kamma, it doesn't mean the ending of action, because that's all kamma means. But it's the the results that would lead to suffering are no longer there. It's also interesting that the Buddha formulates, similar to like the Four Noble Truths, suffering, cause of suffering, cessation of suffering, path leading to cessation of suffering. The Buddha also uses a formulation in a couple suttas where he talks about kamma, cause of kamma, cessation of kamma, path leading to cessation of kamma. It's an interesting perspective. And say kamma that ends in neither good nor bad kamma, the fruition of that kamma doesn't result in any more rebirth or entanglement that would create suffering. That being said, somebody who has realized Nibbana, that's when they really start to do really good stuff. It's just because there's no impediment. There's nothing in the way of that skill. It's like one time, Ajahn Yatiko mentioned this afternoon of Ajahn Mahabua. He's considered a highly realized being. And he'd visited Wat Nanachat. It'd be about 10 years ago now. He visited Wat Bananachat, the international monastery in our circle. And people were asking questions, and he was talking, and it was quite informal. One of the things he said is that for an enlightened being, there's no other response to the human condition than compassion. It's just the way the mind works for an enlightened being. So, which is very beautiful. So that there is that expression, but it's not resulting. It's not coming from attachment. It's not trying to get any particular result, so that there isn't an identification with it, so there's no suffering. Okay. It seems as though letting go is a process, and it doesn't happen quickly. Is this true for you, or can you let go immediately? Depends what it is. I'm getting better at it. it's a process that you cultivate, you work on, you see the benefit, you see the results, and then that gives more encouragement. And then just depending on our own temperament and our own proclivities and defilements, you know, we're able to let some things go fairly quickly, and then some things, they're sticky. You don't want to let go of them. But that's where we can also investigate and recognize, there's still suffering in the mind. I can't let that go yet. So it's an encouragement for practice. This was already discussed, but I still feel confused. In today's talk, you said thought, feeling, experiences are not self, not personal, and to approach them as such. Yet in a previous talk, it was said that all of our experiences are the fruit of our actions, our karma. If we each have a unique and personal karma, how can this not be a sense of self? And how can we know how to approach different experiences? There's that confusion. It's been going on for around 2,500 years. It's a difficult concept to grasp. And even sometimes we might get it intellectually, but sort of feeling-wise, how can something that feels so much like me not be me? But this is where and then when we say not self, or say not personal, we're sort of, yeah, it's causes and conditions that are you know, it's almost like just part of nature, and then that sense of not self is recognizing that all of the things that we identify as self are conditioned, they're constructed, they're built up of these different experiences, different perceptions, and each one of those things is impermanent and unstable. So that how can we find a stable sense of self when all of the conditioning factors are impermanent, unstable, uncertain? So then one starts to recognize that projection of self is just that, it's a projection. You know, because in the present moment, that sense of self seems fairly stable or clear. But if you look back, say, 10 years, you know, one's views, one's opinions, one's perspectives, one's all of that was quite a bit different. And so where did that self go to? That was just a projection onto those different causes and conditioning factors. And it's not really within one's control. I mean, we would love to have a nice, balanced, well-adjusted sense of self. Mm-hmm. And where does that keep disappearing to? we carry around a negative perception of self. And say, is that the whole picture? Because it's never the whole picture, what we conceive of self. It's the whole package, but all of the package is also in a state of flux and changing and it's conditioned. So it's like being able to hold it like that. And that gives a tremendous amount of freedom then. Could you talk a little bit on karma or kamma? Karma is the Sanskrit, kamma is the Pali. We're here living cushy lives in comparison, clean water, comfortable houses, food, because of past good deeds. So could you explain why one might be reborn into hunger, AIDS, civil war? One of the things that the Buddha pointed to as a basis for unhinging the mind and driving oneself nuts is trying to figure out karma. And it's just too complicated, all the variables complex. But that being said, there's still these fundamental principles that one can see for oneself, in that when one, just in ordinary circumstances, if you respond to a situation out of aversion, ill will, aggression, it'll almost certainly elicit some kind of response that is negative and not very pleasant. Or the same goes with you know, something skillful or useful, or you know, one responds to a situation out of kindness or generosity, and that tends to create a response of well-being, of happiness, or warmth and friendship between us as human beings. So just taking that fundamental principle and extrapolating and speculating, those principles follow through on a larger scale, so that in terms of the you know, the grand scale of the universe, and it is probably that same principle working that draws beings to different realms of rebirth, different circumstances in their rebirths. And it's what the Buddha did point to it in a broad brush way, that it's those fundamental, the nature of different actions will put one into different circumstances, and it's just again a sort of a force of nature. It's also something that is impermanent, unstable, uncertain, so that attention to karma in a way that is building the foundation for good qualities, say the conditions that would be conducive to having good friendship, having trust, having spiritual guides. All of these things they're part of the, if we're very conscious, those are the things we want to be cultivating. Because and that's what when we think of the sort of the precious human rebirth, it's because we can exercise those choices and put our attention into and efforts into those action, speech, and mental formations that will facilitate those opportunities for ourselves. Can, and if so, how may one formally take refuge as your lay disciple? Do you think it is useful if one is genuine and sincere about it? I mean, the taking of refuge is it's very powerful. And so that, and especially when, you know, when one does it formally, that's one of the, I would say, the benefits and powers of ceremony or ritual, because it isn't as if sort of all ceremony and ritual is just sort of empty and not beneficial. It's one can use those kind of ceremony as a means for really clarifying what one's doing, clarifying one's intention. It's a powerful reminder for oneself when one does that, and then also in terms of establishing a relationship with a teacher, it does give opportunities for when one has questions or doubts or difficulties, that it's an open channel. to be able to deal with that. So one just is having resources to work with the practice. You know, the taking of refuge on a certain level is a very simple ceremony, it just seems. You know, oh, Buddhang saranam gacchami, Dhammang saranam gacchami, Sanghang saranam gacchami. I take the Buddha's refuge, I take the Dhamma's refuge, I take the Sangha's refuge for the second time, for the third time, and then taking the five precepts. And you think, well, that's, you know, it's over pretty quickly. but it's that you know, formulating the intention, doing it in a formal way. So it's, yeah, this is what I really want to do, and actually that recitation of those, say the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, three times. That was actually the way that monks ordained. And it was still in the early days of the Buddha's teachings, that constituted ordination, a monastic ordination. And it's also something that, in reality, as we continue to explore those refuges, that's, you know, it forms the core, the kernel of liberation, of enlightenment. It's just really knowing in one's heart what a refuge truly is, and you know, because we take refuge in all sorts of things. It's like again Ajahn Mahabua, who's a tremendous energy for practice and teaching, but on a personality level, he's kind of intimidating. He does not suffer fools. If you did something that he thought wasn't right, he'd just bite your head off. You know, and he's kind of scary to approach. I've always had a very, whenever I've met him, he's always been extraordinarily kind to me, and I've had very good, but I know that and I've seen him with other people. I said, whoa. You know, and he seems quite gruff and even angry at times. But one of the things people would write, because he was recognized as such a great practitioner and teacher, then people would write to him asking questions to him. And he would write letters back to people. If people asked about Dhamma practice, he'd always write back to them. Giving them advice but he used to, there's different ways he used to sign his name because somebody who's quite you know, sort of intimidating, but he was quite playful when he was writing, sometimes he was sort of, you know, and he'd give this really good explanation of Dhamma, and then he'd sign it sort of the monk who takes his pillow as refuge. So that the refuge that we take in so many different ways. It's sort of like a jñātiko this afternoon with it, you know, this, it just, things get tough, you go to the fridge. You know, so. Why such a big deal of suffering? Why trying to get out when we know it's impermanent? Again, it's the, as I said, it's sort of like the watering hole of our attention. It's where we can start to see our habits, our conditioning, our tendencies to be confused or deluded by the world, so that it's a helpful motivation, and it's something that just knowing it's impermanent. When something is impermanent, doesn't mean it actually stops. It means it just keeps being impermanent. And that gets tedious after a while. Ajahn, kindly share another story of Ajahn Chah they delight and inspire, perhaps your most memorable personal teaching. You know, I just have to rely on what pops up into the mind, because there are many. Well, one that comes to mind right now is when we were talking about how Ajahn Chah could teach Westerners who didn't have much Thai language, and of course he didn't have English language. And even with using quite simple phrases and simple words, one time I was with him as his attendant, and we were on alms round. He went over on alms round in the back of the monastery, and in the village in the back of the monastery, and then you had to come back through the monastery, through the forest. And we were just walking under a tree, and these two lizards fell out of the tree, and you know, they're probably copulating, reproducing. And then Ajahn Chah said, "You see that? That's the sense desire. Trouble." It was very simple. That's, it was stuck in my mind all this time. Also, I remember one time when I had, it was very early years of being a monk, and just really trying to figure out practice, trying to figure out how to be a monk, trying to figure out training, and, you know, it's a bit of a jumble. And ended up doing something that wasn't correct, wasn't appropriate. And I go to Ajahn Chah and let him know. And it was just had, you know, by following a habit of desire, and let him know what had happened, what had done, and he sat and listened. And, you know, I was waiting. You know, waiting to get scolded, waiting to get rebuked in some way, and he just listened, and then he asked, and it was in Thai. It's very simple. He said, "Bentuk mai?" And I said, "Is it suffering?" And at the moment, it was sort of like, well, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. I mean, it was sort of, I was doing something that was seeking, you know, the easy way or comfortable, seeking comfort. But then you start thinking about it and saying, oh, yeah, even that, these ways that we end up, even something that on the appearance is comfortable, is a way of, you know, creating some ease. Well, even that is fraught. And when you start really investigating and saying, oh, yeah. So that it was just turning attention in a different way and seeing how the assumptions that we make might not be the reality at all. And then, of course, seeing it more clearly, then there's a much more, the impetus to really let go is there. It looks like the same writing, but a bit more of with the asking for another story of Ajahn Chah, but it, no, sorry, but it carries on relatedly. We see the suffering that follows when the house builder Sankara is built again. Yet humans are storytelling animals. Culture, even pop culture, can inspire. Any comment? Well, there's Van Morrison, isn't there? I mean, we are storytelling, and we learn from stories. And of course, we get swept up in our own stories sometimes, or other people's stories. But still, as a learning tool to be able to use stories to say to inspire the mind, to encourage the mind. I can know and let go of a past hurt. But what is a good Buddhist to do when the hurt is direct and in your face? For example, repeated verbal abuse by my partner. Loving kindness can only go so far. Well, one of the things that, you know, when we talk about knowing and letting go, that's on a... a past hurt, a present circumstance that it's appropriate for, but you know there are things that one does need to address. One has to deal with it in some way, and certainly if we take the example of the Buddha, then he was extremely practical. And if we read the suttas, we hear from the discourses and the Buddha teaches this monastic and they become enlightened, or teaches that lay person they become enlightened, and it's all very inspiring. But if you read the Vinaya, which is the book of discipline, and it's like 6 or 7 volumes, that's where all the monks and nuns were up to all sorts of mischief and doing things wrong and getting into arguments, taking advantage of lay people, doing harmful things. The Buddha hears about it, and he calls that monastic in and said, "Did you do this?" And he said, "You one of the strongest rebukes he gives is, Moga Purisa, which is like, you empty fool. that sense of, no, there needs to be something done. So that the Buddha will address that and say, that you can't do that. That's not appropriate. It's not skillful. So those are ways that, there's one has to give oneself the opportunity for redress of situations that are not helpful, they're not supportive of you as a human being. The ways that we deal with it, of course, are enhanced by our ability to approach it with, with Dhamma in the heart, where it's one's able to not get swept up in the reactions of one's own reactions of aversion or frustration, and then also to be able to be quite forthright. So there's a balance that needs to be done. And I can, for myself as a teacher and abbot of a monastery, which it's a long time now, and it's getting on, that would be about 29 years. I've been an abbot, and the early years when I saw things that I thought weren't right or appropriate, but I'd really lose it. And last year when Ajahn Chandoko was here, he was saying, you people, you have Ajahn Pasano and Abhayagiri, and he's this kind, wise teacher. He said, but you should have seen him before. He was scary. And so that, and it's extraordinarily unfruitful. So that I certainly learn from the mistakes I made, and to be able to see something that is unskillful or inappropriate, but then to be able to bide one's time and say things at the right time in the right way so that people can take it on board and use it skillfully, that's something that takes time. But it's also something, say for myself, as I've become more clear, and I can be quite, I can actually be quite blunt with people, and it's just sort of, well, it just needs to be said. So said, and it's on my part, it's sort of done. It doesn't sort of move it. It actually usually has a much better result in the sense that, if it comes from, if there's anger or aversion, but if it's, it's just sort of laid out there, then people can accept it more easily. But it is appropriate to recognize that one shouldn't be just sort of, well, I'm supposed to be a good Buddhist, so I should just sit here and spread loving kindness. But there's one can have loving kindness, but still respond to situations that really need to be redressed and need to be brought to light. I mean, I think of all the people I know, have known, I mean, Ajahn Chah was certainly the person with the most loving kindness I ever met. And that being said, if somebody was out of line, they'd know about it. They'd hear about it. Remember one monk who Westerner, Vietnam vet, big guy, football player. You know, Ajahn Chah is a pretty little guy. He might have been 5 foot. And he just took that monk, sat him down, had a bit of talking to him. And it's really clear, straight, uncompromising. It was really, that person was shattered. Because it needed to be said, because it was just getting out of hand. But that was somebody who'd seen a lot, and that was, it had to be redressed. It was done with kindness in his heart, but it was very truthful. So one has to have that balance. I notice how mind not only loves story, it loves also to be the main character. When I sit down at mealtime across paths in the hall, I watch mind become restless with thoughts of how I am affecting others or what others are thinking of me. Is this conceit? Shall I continue to watch this feeling like all others? Any advice, words, or guidance? Thank you. It is conceit in the sense of how I structured it in terms of the way the Buddha says nine types of conceit. So that anywhere where we put our sense of self. The comforting thing is probably everybody else is exactly the same. We're all the main characters in the drama of our life. I think one watches the feeling that comes from having to. Just like that, that is watching where when we're wondering or worrying how it affects others, how people think of us, just that movement, of mind to be able to, oh wow, that's a complication is not really necessary. It doesn't, and to see that it's complicating repercussions, because then of course it just keeps this sort of this running commentary going, which it's important to not be completely, how do you say, tuned out and insensitive, because that's not useful either. But it's when we see that sense of the mind spinning out another story, and the central character being ourselves, and you think, it's a real burden to carry, and the kindest thing is putting it down, and it's sort of an act of kindness to oneself to not have to carry that. There's a quote that begins, "The solitary Buddha is my noble lord." Please clarify the meaning of this phrase. That's in the verses of sharing and aspiration. And it's toward the end. And it's after doing that sharing and dedicating of the blessings of our good actions, and then setting the aspiration for lifting up various spiritual qualities, there's a reflection on reminding or recollecting the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. And then this phrase is in "the solitary Buddha is my noble lord." What it's referring to is something called a Pajeka Buddha. So that a Pajeka Buddha is a Buddha, a being who is completely liberated, but doesn't teach. They don't have the kind of the past accumulations to teach or to pass on, but they're fully enlightened beings. Traditionally in the scriptures and commentaries, they would arise at a time when there's not a Samma Sambuddha, a Buddha who is capable of teaching and transmitting the teachings, so that they're a purified being. And of course, they're worthy of respect, worthy of offerings, worthy of that sense of appreciation. So that when, and in the chant, of course, it's on a certain level, it's a devotional chant, so you're covering all your bases. Okay, we could have a short break and come back for evening puja.